left behind in South Africa today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This young woman in South Africa was 16 and pregnant when she found out she was HIV positive.
I wanted to hold myself and not to cry, but, you know, I didn't make it.
And she's not alone. In South Africa, young women are twice as likely to become infected with HIV as young men, and that's challenging prevention programs.
So when you talk about 15 to 24-year-old women being particularly susceptible to getting infected with HIV, then you really have to change and focus your program.
We'll hear what's behind that trend and what's being done to reverse it. Our series from South Africa gets underway after the news right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is Friday. Glad we all made it through the week. We begin today with a look at HIV, and it's not all bad news. Globally, HIV rates have stabilized over the past 15 years, and AIDS-related deaths have dropped by half since 2005. Still, there are big challenges. Consider South Africa, where more than 7 million people are HIV positive, and young women there are twice as likely to become infected as young men. Today, we're starting a series of stories looking at the campaign to stop rising HIV rates in young women and girls in South Africa. One teenager story in just a moment. First, though, Deborah Burks has been on the front lines of this effort. She's the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator who oversees the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, known as PEPFAR.
You know, with every pandemic, it's who's susceptible to getting infected and how many are susceptible. So when you talk about 15 to 24-year-old women being particularly susceptible to getting infected with HIV, then you really have to change and focus your program. And that's why 2 years ago we started DREAMS, Determined, Resilient, Empowered, AIDS-Free, and Mentored and Safe Young Women, to really shed a light on the risk factors for young women and trying to mitigate each of those risk factors in a very
right.
clear way.
So what did you learn? I mean, why are teenage girls becoming infected with HIV at higher rates than teenage boys?
That has been studied quite well by two South African researchers, Koresha and Slim Karim, where they showed that young women between 15 and 24 were having sexual relationships with young men who were about 7 to 8 years older and were already HIV positive. If you look in places like KZN and places around Durban, you'll see young women's infection rates by 19 of 19-20%. The young men at the same age are about 3%. I think the other risk factor, we know that a significant portion of young women, up to a third, first sexual experiences may be rape. And we have to recognize that and we have to change that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how much sexual assault plays a role in all this.
About a third.
Wow.
So that is a very key element and it's something that we're very much focused on. And then there's the socioeconomic consequences, often for young women, where they will be making choices between sex and food, particularly in the 19 to 22-year-old age range, when they're trying to attend universities and they're trying to get school fees. It's very complicated.
So the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, what would you say is the priority of PEPFAR today compared with when George W. Bush created it?
President Bush saw the human suffering and saw that there was an amazing loss of life in sub-Saharan Africa. At a time, it looked like we were going to lose an entire generation in these countries. We were going to lose the teachers, the doctors, the nurses, the politicians, and there would be a whole generation that would grow up without mothers and fathers. And I think he really believed that this was our opportunity to really save lives. And I think PEPFAR did that. I think through utilizing data, we realize that not only have we saved lives, but we're changing the very course of the pandemic. And I think that's how it's changed. We've used data to show what we've achieved, but also show what we haven't achieved and very clearly focused our resources to address the things we haven't achieved. And I think that's been the exciting piece to see that we not only through our foreign assistance have saved people's lives, but this will be probably in the history the first pandemic that we will be able to get control of without either a vaccine or a cure.
Let's talk about PrEP for a moment. That's the pre-exposure prophylaxis, the preemptive use of drugs to prevent disease in people who have not yet been exposed to HIV. I mean, it's changed the lives of a lot of gay men in this country. Why isn't it something that is more accessible in sub-Saharan Africa?
You can't access PrEP and you can't access treatment if you don't know if you're HIV positive or negative. And the gap is knowing their HIV status to even make PrEP or treatment relevant to them. That's the work that we all have to do to really raise that awareness among the communities of younger people so that they understand that it's important to know their status, both to be able to access PrEP, but also be able to access life-saving treatment.
Ambassador Birx, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Deborah Birx, the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator. We'll be exploring all these issues over the next few days as our Women's Lives team travels throughout South Africa. Today, why are so many girls getting infected with HIV at such alarming rates? We found some answers in a little mining town right outside Johannesburg. The world's Jasmine Garst has our story.
Ndlandla remembers a winter day like this one, when she had nothing left to say. In South Africa at this time of year, the sunlight comes in oblique, and it almost always feels like dawn or dusk, never quite like a real day. The nurse stood there explaining, and Ndlandla sat in silence. And what was there for her to say, really? She was 16, she was pregnant, and she had just tested positive for HIV. This, she thought, this is how you die.
I wanted to hold myself and not to cry, but, you know, I didn't make it. I cried, and then I cried enough.
She needed to get out of that clinic. In a daze, she picked up her prescription for antiretrovirals, the combination of drugs that suppress the virus. That night, at dinner, she said nothing. She just stared at the food, her eyes welling up. She excused herself.
And then the tears were all over my eyes. Didn't know what to do. I just ate a little bit. And then I went to the room and slept. I didn't even drink that medication.
I meet Ndlandla right after school. She's still wearing her uniform. She's tiny and sweet. She says she wants to be a veterinarian when she grows up. Ndlandla is part of South Africa's great mystery. How does a girl this smart, outgoing, and ambitious not protect herself from HIV? Especially because this country has the highest number of infections in the world. Over 7 million people, 19% of adults. And there is sex education. Ndlandla got it in school. There is birth control. Clinics offer it for free. South Africa even recently got home kits so you can test yourself for HIV. People know how to prevent this. But young women are getting infected at a rate twice as high as men.
We still have a patriarchy in its worst form in Africa, throughout Africa, actually.
It's the patriarchy, says Criselda Kananda Dudumashe. She's a popular talk radio host here in South Africa. She herself is HIV positive, and she hosts a show in which she regularly talks about living with the disease. She says it boils down to sexism. You can tell a young girl about the importance of condoms or abstinence, but that young girl might not feel like she can ask her boyfriend to wear protection or to stop.
Because sometimes you're telling a boyfriend that feeds you how to enjoy sex. And oftentimes that doesn't sit well. Either he's going to beat you up or something terrible happens, like being infected.
So much money has been pumped into the fight against HIV, but Criselda says when it comes to girls, we got it all wrong. This isn't about sex education. This isn't even about sex. This is about teaching girls that it's okay to say no to a man and teaching men to respect that no. Ndlandla's boyfriend didn't respect the no.
I was telling him, where are condoms? We have to use condoms.
The town where Ndlandla lives, Kulinan, is an hour's drive from Johannesburg. It's a mining town. There isn't a lot to do around here, except hang out with your boyfriend.
Most of the time we were partying together, coming from pubs and we were drunk.
She was 12 when she met him. He was 22. He cheated on her. a lot?
This is a personal question, but were you wearing condoms with your boyfriend ever?
No, not at all.
She says when she found out she was HIV positive, she was angry at him. He tested positive too.
I did give up on myself. I did give up on myself.
You know what? She says to me, one time when I was pregnant, I made dinner for both of us. Chicken stew with rice.
I bought this other poison called Alpirim.
She bought Halefirimi, which is rat poison. She was going to put it in the food.
But I didn't even pour that thing into the food. I threw it into the toilet. I didn't do anything.
She didn't say a word. She went to the bathroom, poured the poison down the toilet, came back and served dinner. And she says that is when it came to her.
Yes, I was angry, but, you know, when you find out that you are positive, there is no time for pointing fingers.
And Glantla says she had bigger concerns.
They told me that if I drink my medication correctly, the baby will be born negative.
Negative, meaning HIV-free. Here's the good news. For the first time in history, worldwide, more people who are HIV positive are on antiretrovirals, the drug that suppresses the virus. AIDS-related deaths have fallen by 50%. Also, more than ever before, you can be HIV positive, pregnant, and give birth to a baby that's HIV negative, if you take your medication correctly. Ndlatla remembers when the doctors told her that her baby boy had been born negative.
I was happy. I was so happy.
She named her son Tandulwami.
Tandulwami means my love.
Ndlatla recently turned 18. Her son is 8 months old and he's healthy. She gets help from the organization Mothers to Mothers that works with young HIV-positive moms. She herself feels mostly normal. She's finishing high school next year, and she has moments in which she actually forgets that she has the virus. But she talks about it very publicly. Ndlatla is part of a movement of young people who are coming forward with their positive status.
MTV Sugar presents 16 and Pregnant.
So soon.
This time set in and around Johannesburg.
She was recently on an MTV show about teen pregnancy in South Africa. It was the first time some friends and members of her family found out about her status.
At the clinic, they also tested me for HIV and AIDS and told me that I'm HIV positive.
She says people have been really supportive since the show aired.
I could not believe the test results.
Her ex-boyfriend has been silent about his HIV. He hasn't told his family, and certainly not his other lovers. But Ndlatla told the world a secret, and the world listened.
This is who I am, and I had to accept myself before I expect somebody else to accept me as who I am.
Her days of being quiet are long gone. For the World, Jasmine Garz, Johannesburg.
Jasmine's story was produced in partnership with the MTV Staying Alive Foundation. Speaking of which, tomorrow Jasmine will co-host a Facebook Live with MTV's Tinashe Venge in front of a live audience of teenagers in Johannesburg. If you have questions or comments about Jasmine's story, or more general questions about things like teen pregnancy and contraception, log on to Facebook tomorrow at 10 a.m. Eastern. Just go to Women's Lives. We hope you can make it. Coming up, is it the end of Spain's two-hour lunch? This is The World.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to what you're missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. It feels recently like elections can't help but attract fake news. Kenya has an election next Tuesday to vote for a new president and other offices. People are anxious. For one thing, they clearly remember 2007, when elections sparked a wave of violence and deaths across the country. People were targeted according to their ethnic background. It was ugly. This year, the two main candidates, incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga, one of the candidates in 2007, are locked in a close race. Both are flinging accusations at each other. And on top of that, Kenyans now have to figure out what is real and what's not. Here's Brenna Daldorf from Nairobi.
Last week, two videos emerged on Kenyan social media. Both claimed that the incumbent president, Uhuru Kenyatta, was way ahead in the polls. One appeared to be from the BBC, the other from CNN.
Meanwhile, here are the other headlines at this hour.
News just in from Kenya. In a surprising twist, an online poll...
But here's the deal. In reality, the polls say Kenyatta is neck and neck with his opponent, Raila Odinga. So I dropped by the Nairobi office of Africa Check, the leading fact-checking website on the Kenyan elections. And I asked Kenya editor Alphonse Shiondu what he thinks about the so-called CNN video.
It's a genuine CNN clip, but the first part has been manipulated.
Basically, a fake clip about Kenyatta being ahead in the polls was inserted into a real CNN news bulletin.
It has a CNN international logo, it has the CNN logo, and it has a CNN anchor speaking about stories somewhere in Iraq and Syria. That's like the follow-up clip. It has everything.
The production of these videos is slick, leading many to wonder if political parties are financing them. It's a worrying prospect, especially since some Kenyan politicians, including the current president and his deputy, have been accused of inciting violence in past elections. Kenyans use social media like WhatsApp to share news about the election. But in a recent survey, many say they don't fully trust the information shared online. Shiondu thinks that whoever doctored the CNN video was probably thinking about that.
So you would hear conversations like, I saw this on WhatsApp, and people would ignore it. But when the person adds, it was also on TV or it was also on radio, and now everyone sits up and is like, yeah, you mean? Okay, I'll need to listen to that. That's now the thing they were trying to play around with. Why not create a fake thing and spread it via WhatsApp?
And it's difficult to monitor what's being said or shared on WhatsApp because people communicate on it in closed groups and the data are encrypted. Analysts have nicknamed it a dark social for this reason. And some of the stuff shared on WhatsApp is truly dark. Last month, Kenyan authorities identified 21 WhatsApp groups spreading hate and warned that their administrators would be held accountable. My next stop is Kibera, one of Nairobi's largest slums. In Kibera, rumors are the original fake news, and they've led to bloodshed during past elections. Back in 2007, when Raila Odinga ran as an opposition candidate for president, there were widespread rumors of vote rigging, which were unconfirmed. Kibera is an opposition stronghold, and minutes after Raila's loss was announced, violence broke out here. This year, rumors about the election are flying fast and furious again in Kibera. Steve Oduor lives here. He works with Uma Hakika, a project that aims to debunk rumors before they can wreak havoc, like they did back in 2007.
The most recent rumor that was going around was that the government is planning to deploy military in Kibera to scare away voters, Kibera voters, because Kibera is perceived to be the stronghold of the opposition.
Oduor says that Kibera residents are like everyone else. They tend to believe any news or fake news that fits with their personal beliefs.
Yeah, like those who are supporting the government, if you share something that they feel attacks the government, they'll be like, no, that's propaganda, that's not true. Same thing with those who are on the opposition side.
But he says in the WhatsApp groups that he's part of, he is seeing some positive signs. More people are questioning what's being shared, something he says is new. And he's also seeing a lot of people take to social media to spread messages of peace.
But then we have these campaigns going around, the peace campaigns, that are telling people that everything is going to be fine. We just need to accept what will happen. If your candidate loses, someone has to lose, someone has to win. And that's a bit calming them down.
Oduor, for one, is hoping that come election day, it's the messages of peace that will get the most shares. For the world, Brenna Daldorf, Nairobi.
I want an election with a referendum on siestas, and I'd vote yes. Okay, we Americans don't have a siesta culture like they do in Mexico, Italy, and Spain. Besides, with my job, it'd be close to impossible to have a meal and take a nap for a few hours. I still like the idea, though. It turns out a lot of Spaniards are actually sick of the siesta. They say it makes their daily schedules a major headache, and they want siestas to stop. Amanda Kersey reports.
Here's an easy laugh.
Tonight, shocking footage from Spain. Someone was caught on camera working.
Funny, yes. True, no. Spain isn't the land of lazy days and afternoon naps the rest of us think it is. The average worker actually puts in about the same number of hours and is just as productive as someone in the UK. But the Spanish aren't 9-to-5ers. They're more like 9-to-7ers or later. Like Barcelona lawyer Hernán Martí.
Hola.
Martí is still at his desk at 8 when he takes my call. He runs through his typical workday. In at 9, work until 2, home for lunch, back by 4, out between 8 and 9, dinner at 10, asleep after midnight.
It's a long day. Maybe the worst thing is that every day it's like that.
And even though 7 out of 10 Spaniards say they're satisfied with the workday the way it is, the government wants a change of pace. It's developing a plan to get people to do everything earlier, work, eat, watch TV, sleep. It's even trying to roll the clocks back an hour so the sun rises sooner. The goal? A less tired, more efficient Spain in sync with the rest of Europe. That all sounds good to Gemma Buchacarroyo, a small business owner and mother of two.
Hola. Sí, soy yo. ¿Me oyes bien?
She talks to me on the phone from her home in Barcelona after putting her kids to bed. She and her husband usually work until 8 or 9. Their kids are in after-school activities until 6, which leaves the family schedule out of sync by a couple of hours.
Pero es como no está bien organizado, no está bien montado.
It's not well organized. It's not well set up, she says. If the workday ended at 6, like the Spanish government wants it to, Buchacarroyo wouldn't have to stay late to make up for when she leaves early to pick up the kids. She could do errands after work. The family could spend more time together. I ask her if she thinks switching to an earlier clock would hurt the very idea of Spain.
Yo creo que esto ya está bastante perjudicado por el horario que hacemos ahora.
I think I'm already hurt by the schedule we've got now, she says. So the traditional schedule that makes Spain look lazy turns out to be surprisingly stressful and tiring for many of the people living it. But even the change they're in a hurry for won't come quickly. The most concrete proposal to start fixing all this has already been delayed until 2025. For The World, I'm Amanda Kersey.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The World in Words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The World in Words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Food shortages and rationing in North Korea mean many people there are underweight, which is a problem for a smuggler trying to hide North Korean defectors in China.
He has to fatten them up. He has to put some meat on their bones because the very fact that they're so skinny is a tell for Chinese security forces.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Let's get down to some real numbers about us Americans. There are about 320 million people living in the U.S. About 43 million of us were born abroad. So we're chronicling some of their stories as they navigate life here under this new administration. It's a new project we're calling In Trump's America. Valeria Fernandez is following the story of Katerina Caris Barón and her husband Jesus Barón. Valeria, how'd you meet this couple in the first place?
It was the first 2 months of the Trump administration, and I got a call from a local activist. She said that an American wife's husband had been detained at a local court here in the state of Arizona. And, you know, he was trying to settle some court case that he had, some criminal charges, so he could adjust his immigration status because he was married to a U.S. citizen. But next thing they knew, he was turned over to immigration authorities, not just for deportation, but to be prosecuted for illegally entering the country.
So give us the backstory to Jesus and how he ended up here in the first place in the United States.
Well, Jesus came to the United States at a very young age. He was born in Mexico. He was 5 when he came with his family. And, you know, he's one of those youth that could have qualified for DACA back in 2012. But in 2009, he made a mistake. He got into an accident for driving under the influence of alcohol. And he, like many other youth and immigrants that are undocumented, was faced with the fear, do I go to court and face the possibility of being deported just by entering into the criminal justice system? What do I do? And at that time, back in 2009, he was too scared because the punishment for him, it would have been more than just 30 days in jail. It would have been potentially his deportation. He didn't show up. And that stayed in his record. So what the family tried to do once he got married to his American wife, Catarina Carris Barón, was to try to clear this DUI from his record, to do the right thing, pay the fees, serve the time in jail. But they came to find out that that was a little bit more difficult than they thought.
So how common are cases like this, Valeria, like undocumented immigrants who fall into trouble with the law, want to get right with the law, clear their records, close their cases, and end up in prison?
Well, increasingly, we have a criminal justice system in states like Arizona and other parts of the country that are cooperating more with immigration enforcement. So for starters, you have immigration authorities inside the jails, like ICE. So someone can be detained for a minor crime, and they end up from spending one day in a jail to being set for deportation. But now things are starting to change a little bit more under the new administration. So what is different now is that the Trump administration has a mandate for people that are in the interior of the country, immigrants like Jesus Barón that have ties and family in the United States, could be prosecuted now for illegal reentry. And instead of being deported immediately, what they will face is spending time in a federal prison like he did for 4 months. So I think that what Jesus' cases does is it underscores how undocumented immigrants can get caught in what I call a circle of incarceration that goes from arriving to a local jail to then being sent to federal prison. And this is increasingly happening now as the government is expanding the prosecution of immigration-related offenses. That is the reentry to a country. And of course, that's something that is not uncommon for an undocumented immigrant like Jesus that has a family in the United States and that was raised here since he was 5 years old. So this puts families in a predicament, right?
Big predicament, yeah.
What to do now after they face this jail time, after they face the prison time, stay here in the United States or leave together?
Yeah, so what was the decision that Catarina Carris Barón made, Jesus' wife?
Catarina shared with me there was no doubt in her mind that she was going to be with her husband. Catarina and Jesus had 2 children, Adero, who's 4, Sedona, who's about 2 years old. So Catarina made a decision early on, and not speaking Spanish and not having been in Mexico for many, many years, to move her entire family. So just the very day that Jesus was deported here through Nogales, Arizona, I was able to drive in the vehicle with Catarina as she went to the border to meet him for the first time. And this is what I heard just a few minutes before we crossed into Mexico from her 4-year-old son, Adero.
We're almost to Mexico.
Yep.
We're almost to Mexico. The Mexican's calling. Dad's in?
Yep.
When are we going to be in Mexico?
Really, really soon.
Wow. The Mexico that Dad's in. That is just so heartbreaking. That was back in June. How are they doing now, Valeria?
The family is now in San Miguel de Allende, and I was able, of course, to meet with Jesus just as we crossed the border. And I would like to share a little bit of what he had to say, because it was a bittersweet moment for him and a lot of conflicted emotions for someone who grew up in the United States and pretty much feels like an American.
It's kind of weird being down here, I'm an outcast, and being up there, I'm an outcast. And yeah, it's like I'm caught in between. I feel like I don't belong to either.
Jesus's wife interrupted him after he said those words and said, you know, he didn't have to worry because wherever they are together, that's her home. And that's where I'm going to go to visit them just in a few days. I'm going to go to San Miguel de Allende with the support of the International Women Media Foundation. And I'm going to catch up with the Barrons after the two first months in Mexico. And we will continue to follow their story and document this process of a family making a very difficult choice of trying to have a second chance in another country.
I really look forward to hearing your update on the Barrons from Mexico. Valeria Fernandez, thanks so much for telling us their story.
Thank you very much, Marco.
The Barron story is just one of several we're following as part of our project, In Trump's America. You can read about a Nobel Prize winner, an undocumented medical student, and much more, all on our website, PRI.org. Montreal's iconic Olympic Stadium has undergone a temporary transformation. It's now a refugee welcome center. There's been such a huge influx of asylum seekers, mostly Haitians coming from the U.S. into Canada, that the facilities normally used to house new arrivals have run out of space. So the sports complex agreed to pitch in. On Wednesday, the first busloads of people arrived. They're sleeping on cots in an area by the concession stands. Mireille Paquet is an immigration policy expert at Concordia University in Montreal. Why are there so many asylum seekers coming to Montreal all of a sudden?
So we're experiencing a larger than usual influx of people coming. But I think it's important, especially for U.S. Listeners, to realize that we're not talking about such a big number, like, ultimately, right? So it's bigger than usual, but it's not as big as we can see sometimes people crossing the U.S. and Mexico border. Most of them right now are from Asian descent, and they're reacting to the announcement by the President of the United States that the temporary status they were granted following the Asian earthquake will end at the end of the year. So they'll be asked to leave the U.S. or face the threat of deportation. Mm. So they're traveling by foot to Canada.
I got to say, the first image that popped into my mind when I heard about this story was the Superdome in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. What are the conditions like for the people that are staying at the Olympic Stadium in Montreal?
This is a good question. It's an interesting parallel. From report, people are sleeping on cots and the ambience is camp-like. But I think that for us, what's more important is that we can actually welcome these people and make sure they don't just disappear into nature, right? Mm-hmm. And that way is also to provide them at least with some safety, because when people cross irregularly into the country, they are at risk of being taken advantage of by human traffickers or to enter into dangerous situation, right? So the situation is temporary for them there. They'll be reoriented to other housing situation. But for now, at least, they're safe.
What impact will all of this have, do you think, on relations between the U.S. and Canada?
That's the real question here, right? Because there's a lot of societal pressure for Canada to reconsider its involvement into the Third Safe Country Agreement with the United States. Because of this agreement, basically people that want to claim status in Canada but are currently living in the United States need to cross the border by foot and then claim status in Canada. And so society and a lot of people involved in immigration services or working with immigrants would like Canada to end this agreement. But the reality is that it is really unlikely that the Trudeau government will end this agreement. Doing so would be to question whether the United States is actually abiding to its international obligation when it comes to immigration. And implicitly and diplomatically, it would send a message that the United States is a country that is unsafe and that is a country that produces refugees. So you can see how much of a condemnation that could be coming from another country.
Yeah, so kind of short answer, is Canada likely to just continue absorbing refugees from the United States?
Yeah, it seems like it. I mean, it's hard to see. I mean, all of us that work in this area would love so much to see this agreement being canceled. But the reality is that, yeah, it'd be surprising.
As someone who is from Montreal, can you tell us a little bit more about the history of this stadium where these asylum seekers are staying? I mean, it's not exactly been the pride of the city, has it?
No, and here I'm going to take off my professor hat and put my Montrealer hat. yeah, it's interesting. The stadium was built for the Olympics in Montreal that we had a couple of years ago. Well, more than a couple of years ago, actually. And it's
76,
been ever
right?
Yeah, exactly. And ever since, it's been the object of contention and criticism. So it started from the very strange architecture of it. It's a kind of a round sphere with this interesting piece that is in the air. It also was built
with... Yeah, I never understood what that thing was.
I don't think we do either. in recent years, been used for events when there are conventions or things like that. People will gather there. Some sporting events are still being held. Around the stadium outside also, there's been an attempt to kind of revitalize the area. But it's always been kind of a strange space, which just really doesn't fit well with the rest of the city.
Yeah, an odd stadium, but being put to good use right now.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very personal thing, but to me, I'm actually very happy to see the stadium for once being put to something that I feel really proud of and very happy about, which is the welcoming of people that need protection. So, I'm happy about that.
Well, other than the stadium, you've got a lovely city.
Oh, thank you.
Mireille Paquet, an immigration policy expert at Concordia University in Montreal. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And later on the program, more on Olympic venues, the ones in Rio that ran over budget and are the source of so much anger in Brazil. Right now, though, we're going to stay with the migration theme for a few more minutes, but in a different part of the world. This week, there were reports of a surge in the number of North Koreans fleeing their country through neighboring China. Hundreds do so every year. It seems like a small number, but consider how difficult the journey is. It's basically a 3,000-mile obstacle course involving what's often described as an underground railroad. And as the world's Asia correspondent Patrick Wynn tells us, China is not the final destination.
The Underground Railroad is a smuggling route that North Korean defectors can use to get all the way from frigid North Korea all the way down to tropical Thailand. And Thailand seems like a bizarre terminal destination, but it's actually one of the closer countries that North Korean defectors can reach where they can reliably be handed over to South Korean authorities, because that's the goal. They want to ultimately defect to South Korea.
China, though, doesn't like the defectors coming through, so the North Koreans travel mostly by bus and stay in safe houses run by smugglers. They try not to speak because their accents can blow their cover, and they try not to be seen because their bodies can also give them away. Food shortages and rationing back home means that North Koreans tend to be much thinner than either Chinese or South Koreans.
One thing that a leader of a Christian smuggling network told me is that the first thing he does when he gets North Korean defectors into China, brings them to a safe house and starts feeding them. He has to fatten them up. He has to put some meat on their bones because the very fact that they're so skinny coming out of North Korea is a tell for Chinese security forces.
Assuming the North Korean defectors can traverse China undetected, they then have to cross through neighboring Laos, another place where they have to steer clear of communist authorities. That part of the trip features treks through the tropical jungle and hopping on a boat to cross the Mekong River to finally reach Thailand. Once there, Patrick says, the defectors want to get noticed.
The first thing that a North Korean defector wants to do when they get to Thailand is they want to get arrested. They will literally go up to a police officer, they will walk into a police station and say, I'm an illegal migrant, you have to arrest me. Once they're in the detention system in Thailand, South Korea can then flag them and they can process them and bring them to Seoul. This is the goal. They want to get to South Korea. They want to assimilate into South Korean society, and the South Korean government will give them money, debrief them, give them every opportunity they can to make sure that they can properly assimilate.
The World's Patrick Wynn in Bangkok describing the underground railroad used by North Koreans to defect via Thailand. So Paris gets the 2024 Summer Olympics and Los Angeles gets the 2028 Games. For a while, though, it seemed like the Olympics were an abandoned child. Several cities, including our own Little Boston, pulled out of the running because, frankly, getting the Olympics is a mixed bag. Just ask people in Rio de Janeiro. A year after Rio hosted the Games, Brazilians are saying there's a big gap between what was promised and what was delivered. Reporter Catherine Osborne is based in Rio. So let's start with the promises, Catherine. What was said that these Games would bring to Rio?
Authorities in Brazil, when they talked about the plans for the Games, both to the IOC and to Brazilians, said they would bring about long-term transformations in the city. So for Rio, those included a new policing program for low-income parts of the city, and there was a pledge that the bay would be cleaned up and that new public transportation lines would be built. And Rio's ex-mayor, Eduardo Paes, said, quote, "I like the Olympics because they're an excuse to do things you wouldn't normally do. But now that the Games are over, what we've seen is that they've mostly benefited residents of a wealthy suburb where the Olympic Park was built. And they spent billions of dollars in a way that a lot of people have condemned as irresponsible. The security situation in the city is really sad. Policemen are getting laid off because there's not enough money to pay for them. The state university has had to cancel the semester for the second half of the year. There are several ways in which the reality has just fallen short of these promises.
Did anything work out? Like, what was delivered that will be a lasting legacy for the Cariocas?
There was an investment in public works and museums to revitalize the old city center. And this is near a place called Praça Mauá. And it's something that urban planners here have been calling to do since the 1910s, actually. In addition to that, metro and high-speed bus lines were expanded. But again, it's complicated because their routes mostly lead to the wealthy suburb where the Olympic Park was built and not along the lines that most commuters need in their daily public transportation.
If we go back to 2009, when Brazil's economy was booming, Rio found out it would be hosting the FIFA World Cup in 2014, followed by the Olympics in 2016. How did the political chaos that followed play into how the Olympic Games are handled?
The biggest political event on the national level between the Games' planning and their implementation is that economically there's been a recession, and then politically there's been a federal anti-corruption probe that's uncovered corruption at federal, municipal, and state levels and uncovered a lot of bribery in public works. Mm. And so many of the companies that built the Olympic Park, which are big construction giants, are the main perpetrators of this corruption scheme that's now been revealed. Rio's ex-mayor Eduardo Paes is being investigated for allegedly taking at least $5 million in payments to facilitate construction projects tied to the Olympics. So in the corruption probe that's really uprooted politics here, Olympic projects are found almost at every turn. And it's just revealed what people were worried about and suspicious about from the beginning.
So how would you characterize how many people in Rio feel about the Games today? Was it worth it? Do they have buyer's remorse? Do people even recall having fun?
They recall some key moments. I think it would have been extreme disaster if Brazil had not won the soccer match at the Games. That was like a pure moment of joy and vindication, especially after the World Cup loss to Germany in 2014.
2 years before.
Exactly. And so that was a genuine moment of pride and joy. But right now, looking back a year afterward, buyer's remorse sums it up, and just real sadness and, to be honest, danger for a lot of people in the city who either can't be seen in public hospitals that are closing down, live in neighborhoods where there's continued shootouts, and a lot of sort of dreams being deferred as far as going to university, starting businesses, carrying out your life as normal. So it's a grave anniversary here. No one is celebrating.
Catherine, what advice do people in Rio have for cities that will host the Olympics in the future?
So one of the main slogans of Rio residents here who have been critical of the Games is they ask, "Olympics for whom?" It's important to have transparency at all the stages of the planning process and for citizens to say, you know, if billions of dollars are going to be invested, be it public or private money, this is an opportunity to hopefully make a change that's good in the long term for what the people want and not just what is good for big businesses. So, you know, to keep a close eye on all these processes as they're unfolding, to think about long-term needs of the city, and just really pressuring elected officials and not being afraid to say, you know, listen, we do have agency in this.
Reporter Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro, thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Time for a little walk-off music for an Olympic star. Usain Bolt, the fastest man in the world. When he was a boy, used to run around, now he's grown up, he fast like lightning. Born Jamaican, love him in the worldwide, number one speed man striking. Be the fastest, be the fastest. Tonight in London at the World Athletics Championships, Usain Bolt runs his final 100 meters. It was the event that gobsmacked the world in Beijing in 2008. And then at the World Championships in Berlin, even faster, 9.58 seconds, a world record that is yet to be broken.
Jamaica, Jamaica, great! The big man clock, 9.58! While the whole world chanting.
It'll be bittersweet for running fans around the globe. Usain Bolt made people giddy when they met him, even American presidents.
Nobody's ever been faster than this guy. Ever. Of all the billions of people. Hold on a second. Wait, should we get a pose here?
Obama couldn't help himself. He just had to ham it up with Usain Bolt and posed with him, pointing iconically to the sky. Most of all, though, this final 100 meters will be bittersweet for Jamaicans. They love Bolt. Love him. Just listen to all the musical homages paid him since that jaw-dropping run in Beijing. Earlier, we heard London remixers Archbirds, who recorded their tune Be the Fastest, on location in Jamaica, with Usain Bolt in a club showing off his dance moves in the video. And this is Jamaican dancehall star Vybz Kartel with his praise song to the sprinter.
Tell it on the mountain how I turn. Go tell the boys, go tell the girl. Usain Bolt is the fastest man in the history of the world.
Usain, you're seeing.
Lightning Bolt.
Usain, you're seeing.
Lightning Bolt.
Bolt, Lightning Bolt. I still can't believe that this guy's name really is Bolt, but Usain St. Leo Bolt is his full name. Here's one more musical homage to Lightning Bolt.
I need to go faster.
Faster than lightning.
American DJ and producer Steve Porter made some beats and then mashed them up with Bolt's voice from various interviews over the years. This is called Faster Than Lightning.
I get the energy. I get the speed. No matter who you are, no matter what you're doing, you're not gonna catch me. You're not gonna beat me. It's all about focus. It's all about power. Get the top speed. No matter who you are, no matter what you're doing, you're not gonna catch me, you're not gonna beat me. I need to go faster.
We'll see. The only thing faster than 9.58 is, well, 9.57. We will miss you, Usain Bolt. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. And remember Usain Bolt's advice: when you hit top speed, turn on the afterburners, and have a great weekend.
He's got that supernatural speed, Mr. Bolt. You know what I mean? Supernatural speed.
PRI, Public Radio International.